Time is 1:55 PM on April 2nd. For the record, we have Representative Harris, Whitaker, Bundy, Co-Chair, or Representative Davies, Co-Chair Mulder, and myself. We do have a quorum. We have three bills up today. And we'll start with 344, House Bill 344. Or maybe we won't, huh?
As I say, I see the sponsor of 160.
We move, we adjourn. If they're not here when we're here, they'll be here after we're gone.
I'm here to speak on behalf of, but DMV is their bill, and we do support it at public safety, but I thought that they would be online.
She is?
Yeah, Anchorage.
It's not my intention to move this bill today anyway, but it's nice to have the sponsor around. We'll wait, and then we'll go to House Bill 160. Which the sponsor is here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Good afternoon, sir.
My name is Representative John Coghill from District 32, Fairbanks area. I have before you House Bill 160, and I want to thank you for hearing the bill. This is the reporting of induced termination of pregnancies. It's asking the department of vital in the vital statistics area to report on abortions. It's making it mandatory reporting. The bill protects confidentiality. This is one of the things we did in the Judiciary Committee, was make sure that the reporting form was not giving any information that was sensitive or could be traced to an individual. So there are a couple of reasons for doing this. Some of the policy decisions that we've tried to get to over the last few years have begged the question on how many abortions are, in fact, happening in Alaska. With regard to some of the health issues, whether it's teens' health, women's health, or how we're going to respond to some of the other policy issues, from contraception to education issues. I think that this information could be important. It would have a reporting period of 30 days, if I remember correctly, and then would have an annual report through the vital statistics area. Most of these states in the union do this already. If I understand correctly, if my information is still accurate, there are three states that don't. And I think, and I'll have to have some of my stats verified by my helper here, the aide that's going to be with me today, Danielle Serino. But it's also true that most of the states go through vital statistics instead of through epidemiology. Some of the things we had to do in Alaska was to shore up the reporting confidentiality. There is a fiscal note on this bill, hence it's in this committee, $71,800. But just to dangle a carrot in front of you, there are things that the CDC and other federal granting programs that would help us straighten up some of our reporting issues, since there is a kind of a national move, even within the CDC, to kind of standardize some of the reporting procedures, which this is modeled after, quite frankly, Mr. Chairman. So I have the bill in front of you. I have a support from the ACLU, believe it or not. They also recognize a need for some of the statistical gathering. Many times I found myself at odds with the ACLU on various issues, and this one we are marching the same pathway, and I appreciate their testimony. The packet in front of you should have a standard report of induced termination of pregnancy. It's this form, as well as the ACLU support letter. And some of the things that we don't know about abortions in Alaska, for example, how many happen each year? How many happen because of health issues, whether it be fetal anomalies or other issues, and how the effects of the health of the mother may be determined because of these issues, and the results of teen pregnancies. What percent of abortions are performed in the various different trimesters and what the health effect of that is, and how many are happening in the rural area versus the urban area, and how that health effect is. So the bill, pretty straightforward, and I would entertain any questions, and I would ask that you help me support this bill.
Are there any Representative Davies?
Thank you. I see the how you get most of the information that you just talked about, but I guess I'm a little puzzled by how you get the information on what the health effect is, since, I mean, you've gone through, I think you've done an admirable job of ensuring the confidentiality, but I guess I'm not sure where we get the information about subsequent health outcomes.
Yeah, that's a good point, and thank you, Representative Davies. The health effect would be just comparing with other health stats that we have in Alaska. So this itself is not asking for any comprehensive reporting. This is just going to be one more tool that we'll be able to use in deciding what is actually going on in the health world in Alaska.
So your intent is to get that other in conjunction with other already existing
Absolutely.
Information?
Yes.
I see. Thank you.
Any other questions for the sponsor? Representative Bundy?
Well, you have indicated an unusual source of support. Someone who doesn't always agree with you. I'm sure there are other organizations that don't always agree with you on this issue. And will we hear from them, or have you heard from them, like Planned Parenthood and others?
I haven't heard from Planned Parenthood on this one. I personally, but now my staff indicates that we may have.
For the record, my name is Danielle Sweeney, staff to Representative Pankow through the chair, Representative Bundy. Planned Parenthood and the Alaska Right to Life organizations testified on behalf of this bill in previous committee hearings and judiciary and whatnot. And after some amendments had been made through the House committee hearings and judiciary, both support this legislation.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Might I suggest that they have a role for these two in Palestine and Israel? Because if you can do that, that's a small task compared.
Well, and the reason is because it's a win-win for either side of the issue, through the chair, Mr. Bundy, Representative Bundy, and that is that the reporting of teen pregnancies, for example, has certain monetary benefits to Alaska and the termination of pregnancies to Planned Parenthood, and in my particular case, it would have benefit to make a case for some of the public policy issues. So. Even though we might come at it from different angles, the information is still important for both parties.
Representative Davies.
Thank you. Representative Cockrell, on page 3, in section 6, where you're amending the definition of fetal death.
Yes.
I'm wondering if this change in the definition has any... I can understand in a straightforward way why you'd want to change that so that it fits in this list of other, you know, birth, death, fetal death, marriage, divorce, et cetera, in that list of statistics. But I guess my concern is, does this have any other implications in terms of insurance, in terms of other kinds of rights of the mother, the family involved, or are there any other kind of implications here other than kind of what we see right in front of us?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Davies, I'll have my staff kind of clean up some of my language, but this is already in statute, and this is something that is reported already through vital statistics, and what we'd added was a section B there on what an induced termination of pregnancy was. And so,
sure.
But
well, yeah, that's what I wanted, the addition of that or the amendment of the definition with that section B. My question is, does that have any implications on insurance or any other implications like that?
Good question. We have maybe Representative, maybe Ms. Serino has an answer.
Through the chair, Representative Davies. These definitions are standard pretty much throughout the state, and it should not. I think one of the problems here is most states have delineated between fetal death and induced terminations a number of states, including Alaska, I think, didn't make that determination after the Roe v. Wade decision, and most states just had all fetal deaths lumped together in one category. And with this bill, it's necessary to separate them out, and these definitions are pretty much standard, medical and otherwise. So I don't anticipate it would have any negative effects as far as insurance areas or whatnot.
So to your knowledge, there's no implications other than just clearing up the definitions?
Yes.
And obviously, it's not standard throughout the state of Alaska since this is new, but you're saying it is standard in other states?
Through the chair, yes.
Any other questions for the sponsor at this time? Representative Hudson.
Thanks, Chairman. Representative Coghill, I'm sorry I missed your opening salvo here. The purpose is for what?
Primarily, Representative Hudson, through the chair, is just to get the number of abortions performed in Alaska and recorded through the Department of Department of Health and Social Services through the vital statistics. And so the information then could be used for a variety of different policy call issues and or health studies. So anything from women's health to some of the policy calls that we make on abortions is my intent. And
from a vital statistic point of view, through the chair, we record the birth and we record the death, and I'm assuming that this is the an element of in between there that does not exist in our state. Is that correct? There's no reporting at the present time?
That's correct, with the exception of what may happen under some of the Medicaid payment issues. But as far as vital statistic, no. We do report live births, fetal death, I think, that Representative Davies referred to, some of the sexually transmitted diseases, I think, are reported through vital stats, and marriages, those types of things. And this would fall right within that category. The only new addition to this is that this particular category would be protected to some degree for privacy reasons, which we put in the Judiciary Committee substitute to make sure that no information got out that would be harmful to anybody, any of the participants.
So privacy is protected?
Yes, sir.
Any other questions? No, thank you. We'll go through the public hearing. We'll hear from the department.
And I'll stay here for questions. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah.
Anyone from the department? Karen Pearson?
Thank you. For the record, Mr. Chairman, I'm Karen Pearson, the Director of the Division of Public Health, and I would just like to commend the sponsor for all of the work and the changes that were made in committee to bring this in compliance with the Center for Disease Control guidelines and the privacy protections that were so important. And with those changes, the department supports this bill.
Any questions for Karen? Representative Davies?
I just ask you the same question I asked regarding Section 6. In making the change in the definition of fetal death that we're making here, does that have any other implications other than for these statistical reporting purposes?
Through the chair, Representative Davies, no, it doesn't, because anything that has to do with insurance or anything has to do with the medical chart that would be maintained. This is information that just puts a new reporting category for vital statistics without identifiers.
And the fiscal notes attached to the bill, this is currently occurring.
Through the chair, yes, we do, Representative Davies.
Any questions for Karen at this time?
Thank you. Is that a motion, Mr. Chairman?
I have several people I would like to. We do have Karen Rossborough.
Yes, I'm here.
Naturally, yes. Come in loud and clear. State your name and your affiliation, please.
My name is Karen Rossborough, and I'm the Executive Director for Alaska Right to Life. I'm just very happy that this is going forward so smoothly. I do have a few questions, however. In this reporting, would we have information pertaining to what trimester the abortion takes place and the age of the mother, whether she's married or single, the most common complications during the abortion, or if there's a death, would we have the cause of abortion, whether it's embolism or hemorrhage or whatever complication, infection, there's many different causes. Would we know whether the abortion was performed on an outpatient basis or at a doctor's office, or what type of abortion was used? Will we have all this information?
Get the sponsor back up here.
Thank you for that question, and Mr. Chairman, the standard report form that is being followed by from the CDC would say what type of abortion, would give see if I get my bifocals to work here, whether it was a live birth, gestational period, so that would give whether it was first, second, or third trimester. It would give national origin or race stats, and if there was other terminations. But with regard to the type of clinic, I don't understand. I don't know if I have the answer to that question. So I'll ask my staff to help me there.
Through the chair. The information that's on the standardized form here would contain many of the information that Ms. Wasberg mentioned, but the individual reports would not be accessible to the public. So the department's overall final report in the end would contain most of those data, but nothing that would indicate any identifying factors involved with the patients.
Would it, if there was a death involved because of an abortion, would that be the cause of the death? I mean, we wouldn't have to have the name of the person involved, but would the cause of death be reported? Would we have access to these type of statistics?
Through the chair, I believe so.
If there was any other anomaly other than just the fact that it was a termination of pregnancy, I think that would probably be reported. However, I think that we're asking for in the statute here just a report of the fact that it was a termination of pregnancy.
Because I'm just concerned because many times, when women die because of an abortion, I believe that information needs to be accessible. And I'm just concerned about that it wouldn't be hidden under maternal or due to pregnancy, that it would be accurate and state that her death was because of an abortion. I am concerned about that.
You have any other comments?
No, that I'm finished. Thank you so much.
Thank you. We'll go to Fairbanks. Ann Harrison, please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Hi, my name is Ann Harrison. I am a retired women's health nurse practitioner. I am a Fairbanks representative on the state Planned Parenthood board, but I speak for myself in this. I'm really for this bill because when I was in active practice, I really wanted very accurate information. So I think this is a really, really good idea to get that information. By the way, I thank those committee members that were there on time. Almost every hearing I attend, the committee members are late in coming, and it's sad because many people who might be testifying aren't able to come because there's no set time, and active professionals are hard. It's hard for them to pull away from their responsibilities. Anyway, so I applaud those of you that respect the time of your constituents. Anyway, as I said, I really think it's a good idea to have accurate statistics when they're used for scientific and research purposes. I'm a little bit concerned about what might be the inevitable leaks. Government seems to have leaks here and there, and I'm always concerned about the well-being, even the life of providers that might be providing abortions. There was some of the wording in Section 6 that I guess this has been worked over by the Judiciary Committee, so I guess it's probably legally okay, but I was a little concerned about the fetal death being defined as a before complete expulsion, and just wondering if by chance there was any sign of life in the fetus after an abortion, if this would put the provider any kind of legal jeopardy. In Section 8, line 2, it says the induced termination of pregnancy means the purposeful interruption of an intrauterine pregnancy. I would put a period there, and it seems the next phrase is rather redundant and has more emotional rather than clinical connotations. And then the last part, the management of prolonged retention of products of conception, really seems very vague and unclear to me from a clinical standpoint. So I'll leave that to the authors to maybe clean that up a little bit. That's all I have to say. I'm looking forward to a very thorough, accurate report on the number of abortions that are done in the state of Alaska. Thank you.
And Representative Davies has a question.
Yeah, and John Davies here. Could you repeat that last site that you had? I was trying to follow your first comment, and I didn't get back to where you were talking about putting a period in and changing some things. Could you repeat that?
Section 8. It's on the back page of my printout. I don't know where it is on yours, and it's in the parentheses of 19 before it. It begins, induced termination of pregnancy means the purposeful interruption of an intrauterine pregnancy. That says it needs to be said. There should be a period after that, and the next phrase, which is with the intention other than to produce a live-born infant, that does not result in a live birth. Well, yes, that's what it's doing, but that seems very redundant to me because it's saying what was already said in the first part of that sentence. And then the second part of that is just more of a clinical issue. It's not real clear to me what they're saying about the
retained product of conception
following a fetal death. Not
sure why it's in there, period. But that's maybe more for some clinicians to look at.
All right, thank you very much.
And, Representative Mr. Chairman, just from the Family Planning Perspectives, Volume 30, Number 5, a publication put out by Family Planning in their Appendix B, and I can get this a copy to you, under their fetal death definitions, we copied that pretty much verbatim with, we did cut it down a little bit, and then with your permission, I'll read it to you if you wish, so you can follow along in the statute. It says, fetal death means death prior to the complete expulsion or extraction from its mother of a product of human conception, irrespective of the duration of pregnancy, and which is not an induced termination of pregnancy. The death is indicated by the fact that after such expulsion or extraction, the fetus does not breathe or show any other evidence of life, such as beating of the heart, pulsation of the umbilical cord, or definite movement of voluntary muscles. Heartbeats are to be distinguished from transient cardiac contractions, respirations, or to be distinguished from fleeting respiratory efforts or gasps. So that's a much more definitive, I suppose, but I think for stats or statistical gathering purposes, the language you had there still was fairly good.
Okay. We'll discuss that in a bit. Next we'll go to Anchorage, Bob Lynn. Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Yes, good afternoon. My name is Bob Lynn. I'm the president of Alaska Right to Life. And is this a basic right to life issue? Yes, in some ways it is, but I'm not here to discuss the issue of abortion. I'm here to urge you to pass HB 160 out of committee, because whoever one stands on abortion, more and better information can do nothing less than help. It's surprising to many people on both sides of the debate that Alaska is one of the very few states that doesn't monitor or collect any abortion data, and I don't think we should be operating in the blind. It's surprising because it doesn't take a rocket scientist to understand that accurate information on abortion, or anything else for that matter, makes it possible for governmental policymakers and health providers to have the facts needed for critical decisions. Decision makers shouldn't have to guess when it comes to decisions involving the health of mothers and the situations which leads some women to seek abortion. Passage of HB 160 would assist all 50 states and national health agencies in publishing and evaluating accurate abortion information in relation to other important health information, especially as it relates to women. One can only speculate on the motivation of anyone who would want anything less than accurate data. Abortion data could be used by both the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the Al Guttmacher Institute. Of course, neither of these organizations is remotely pro-life, certainly not the Guttmacher Institute, which comes under the folks at Planned Parenthood. Whatever, data from abortion surveillance can be used in conjunction with birth data and fetal death computations to estimate pregnancy rates and other maternal health rates. Abortion data can also be used for defining characteristics of women who are at high risk for unintended pregnancy. An ongoing annual surveillance can be used to monitor trends in the number, ratio, and rate of abortions and can provide data for assessing changes in clinical practice patterns related to abortion. And I would think that abortion clinics would want that also. Last but not least, some studies have shown an association between induced abortion and breast cancer. Accurate reporting of abortion linked to the reporting of breast cancer could resolve some of these questions which are so critical to women's health. Again, I urge passage of HB 160, and quite frankly, when the ACLU and Planned Parenthood agree to the last right to life, I think it's time we all pay attention. Thank you.
Thank you. Is anyone in the audience that cares to testify at this time? Anyone else on teleconference? We'll close public testimony at this time. Any other questions or discussions on House Bill 160? Representative Davies?
Thank you. Representative Cockle, could you tell me what the purpose in having the rest of the language on page 4 and section 8 is that Ms. Harrison referred to? Did you have any problem putting a period after the word pregnancy and deleting the rest of that?
Through the chair, I would just soon leave the language in there. Maybe I'll have my staff explain, because we were writing notes back and forth here, but the reason is because we have the DNC issue. So Ms. Serino can answer.
Through the chair, for the record, my name is Danielle Serino. Representative Davies, the induced termination of pregnancy definition we would want to keep because, once again, it is standard. It is what the Centers for Disease Control recommend, and I think it is very descriptive the way it's written, and we also wanted to include the part that says it does not include management of prolonged retention of products of conception in relation to DNC procedures following miscarriages.
And Mr. Chairman, just to follow up on that, if you were to change it, I would then ask that you accept the Planned Parenthood language that was a little more lengthy, so that we would make sure that the complete information was described.
Representative Davies.
Mr. Chairman, I don't have any problem with the earlier language that you cited. I'm just, I too, when I read this thing in Section 8, had no idea what I was reading. I don't know what that means or what the significance of it is. And maybe there's some other issues here that maybe the department
can
help us with or something.
Could I call Karen up here too, please? Maybe what you could do,
just pull the chair, yeah.
Pull open the leaves. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Watch your arm.
Perhaps I can answer the last part of that question for Representative Daisy. The last part of that definition is intended to clarify sort of what Representative Coghill's aide says, which is to not misclassify the outcome of a procedure where the fetus has already died, but that the woman is not naturally going into labor and they need to induce her in order to deliver that fetus at that point. It's not a living fetus that they're going in to do an induced termination, but for whatever reason, the fetus has already died, and they need to do a procedure to get an expulsion. And that's what, so it talks about prolonged retention of the products. So that you get an accurate count of what are actually induced terminations versus the procedures that are necessary to deliver a baby, a fetus that's no longer alive.
All right, thank you.
Okay. Any other questions or discussions? Okay, Mulder.
Mr. Chairman, recognizing the fiscal note that was just turned out or brought out by the committee, pointing out $89,000 fiscal note for 2003 and $39,000 fiscal note in subsequent years, I would move that we pass from committee CS for HB 160 with individual recommendations and accompanying fiscal note.
Any objection?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Chairman.
Next, we'll go to 208. Is the sponsor here? We're having trouble with these sponsors.
Mr. Chairman, I'm feeling like we're in the Senate Minority Caucus or something. I see two minorities.
Oh, yeah.
And you have a quorum.
We have a quorum.
Representative Scalzi.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Co-chairman and members of the committee for hearing House Bill 208. It is a change in the way the Department of Fish and Game will allow mariculture sites to be developed, and currently what is in statute now. Under the current provision, applicants will go out and find a site that they feel is applicable to developing mariculture. Under this current statute, we have a regulatory problem where people will go out and find a site, come back to the Department of Fish and Game, and find that it conflicts with another use. Under this bill, the department will go out and find 90 sites, make them available, and already do the work to find out whether there is conflicts conflicts in the area, so they will predispose any problems that we currently have. As I said, it will allow a lease of 90 sites. Department of Fish and Game and Department of Natural Resources will set the criteria. 60 would be for suspended cultures, such as mussels or oysters. 20 sites will be for clam farming, and 10 sites specifically for gooey ducks. Sites will be available for lease annually until they're taken. A 10-year lease is required. Farmers must abide by the sustained yield principle in harvesting. And if present, farming would not interfere with established commercial, subsistence, or personal use fisheries. Upon expiration of a lease, a permittee must return the site in the condition that mirrors the population estimates that currently were there when the lease started. The bill is the first step by the state in supporting the development of shellfish farming in Alaska since the enactment of the Aquatic Farm Bill back in 1989. The demand for Alaska shellfish in the marketplace cannot be met with a small amount of farms that are now present. As you know, the word Alaska connotes pure, clean, safe waters, and the demand is very high. It was interesting to learn that this little state of Connecticut has 50,000 acres under lease, and the state of Alaska has 500. I think there's kind of an imbalance there, especially when you determine the amount of clean water and unspoiled areas that we have up here. Shellfish farming is an excellent opportunity for displaced fishermen or fishermen who need to supplement their income. A 10-acre farm annual harvest could produce 435,000 pounds of clams worth $1.1 million. Reporting from Favco, which is Alaska's largest seafood wholesaler, estimates the market in Anchorage alone with little neck clams is over 1 million pounds a year. Certainly that could be supplemented right here in the state. Right now, most of their production comes from other areas outside the state. Roger Painter is here, who is from the Shellfish Growers Association, and he'll answer any of these questions that are more technical. I would like to say that Senator Torgerson has a companion bill on the other side that complements this one. And in all fairness to Representative Ropert, I figured I'd better pass a bill with a fiscal note that would have some challenge to it. All these fish bills I've brought to you so far have had none, so I'm trying to even up the score. If there's no questions for me, I'd like to bring Roger Painter up at this time, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Representative Hudson?
Maybe to the...
Come on up, Roger.
Yeah.
To the author, I'm looking at the fiscal notes, and I haven't perused the bill to the extent that I should yet here, but do the fees to set this program up, Representative Scalzi, received from the leases anticipated to cover the costs in this whole situation? We have several fiscal notes here of, say, $90,000 and $90,000. Is that your anticipation?
Through the chair, Representative Hudson, my anticipation on the fiscal notes is the best estimate by the Department of Fish and Game. There is some argument, and Roger could speak to that, as to why these fiscal notes are at this level. But the estimates that I've seen is that over a 10-year period, the collection from the lease themselves should pay for this amount that's determined in the fiscal note to set this program up.
Over a 10-year period.
Over a 10-year period, that's correct.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions? Roger, you care to comment?
Thank you. For the record, my name is Roger Painter, and I'm with Alaskan Shellfish Growers Association. I think the cost of this bill is probably on everyone's mind as you look at it. I would draw your attention on Section 2B, it starts out, before offering leases for aquatic farming sites under A of this section, Commissioner of Natural Resources shall solicit nominations of sites suitable for aquatic farming from the aquatic farming industry in the state and the public. The Alaskan Shellfish Growers Association is actively working with the University of Alaska and have been for the past year doing assessments on candidate sites. And it is our intention to provide nominations that for sites that where there's a considerable amount of data available for the agencies to examine. Under the current leasing program, when an application comes forward, the applicant, the burden is on the applicant to provide site-specific information. That's what keeps the cost of the current program low. And it's our belief that the state, under this lease sale program, also should request and require that the sites that are nominated have some information, site-specific information provided, to keep the cost of the program down. I believe that looking at the current fiscal notes, that it is possible to reduce the fish and game fiscal notes considerably. If you go carefully through the language on the fiscal notes, you'll see that they're both the Confish and the Habitat is notes are predicated on visiting the sites. I would point out under the current program, during a normal opening, Fish and Game does not go out and visit these sites. They do not conduct dive surveys. Again, the applicant is required to provide that information. And I think this program should follow the same lines to take the burden away from the state and put it on the industry to provide this information. I know we could provide it at a much lower cost within the state. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any questions, Representative Davies?
Well, I guess my question is, if you're going to do that, why don't we just operate under the existing statute then?
Through the chair, Representative Davies, the prime attraction of this particular program is that these sites would be located in an area, areas of low conflict, and probably try to focus them in on areas where the industry is really being encouraged. As an example, we're working down on Prince of Wales now with local communities, governments, on trying to identify areas and to work with the agencies to mitigate any kind of conflicts and then encourage applicants to come in. And the community is going to look at its infrastructure, how it could deal with supporting the industry developing in its area. The cost of this program that we're trying to get underway is pretty significant. We were looking at a very small area on Prince of Wales Island. It would require amending current land use plans for the area, conducting a series of public hearings. DNR developed an estimate of the cost of the Prince of Wales project of about $140,000, and that would result in just a very small number of sites compared to what this bill would create. This would allow the applicants to go into areas where it's pretty certain they're going to be allowed to farm. There's been a great deal of problems, particularly in South Central Alaska, finding sites that are suitable and will make it through the process. In the 1999 opening South Central, there were like a dozen sites proposed, and not a single one of them was approved. And applicants were so discouraged, I believe, that in this latest opening in Prince William Sound, there's in all of South Central, there's one application, only one. And I think this legislation would open the doors by pointing interested people to areas where they're probably going to be successful.
Representative Davies.
I'm still confused about. So why do you think that the department can find areas that, that may be approved when the people that have been looking haven't been able to find these areas?
Through the chair, Representative Davies, I think the department's role, in my mind, is less to go out and identify those sites initially, but to respond to the nominations that are brought in by industry and local governments and evaluate those for conflicts, sensitive habitats, other issues that would might lead to these sites being rejected.
If I may respond. Thank you, through the chair. An example would be in Ketchumak Bay, where you have a more populated area. There's a lot of home sites in that area, and people are not as conducive to having more mariculture sites in some of those areas right now. There's argument that there should be, but the Department of Fish and Game, Habitat Division, and Comfish have had to deal with those personal relationships between user groups, and I think that they would be certainly more objective up front in dealing with that than an applicant who comes in and tries to make a case for an area that take up a lot of time and will, in the end result, be fruitless. So I think that's why the burden should be put on the department, Habitat, DNR, and also later on in the game, DEC, to make those determinations and expedite the process.
Any other questions for the sponsor, Representative Hudson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Roger, you've been in this business now for some time.
Your farm sites, are they accessible by road at all, or is it all boat, by boat?
Through the chair, Representative Hudson, they are close to the road system in on Prince of Wales, but about a two-mile boat ride away.
And is that what you anticipate down in Kachemak Bay, for example, that they would be pretty much isolated? So I'm thinking now of not only the cost of identifying the sites, but the cost of maybe providing access so that they could be economic. Do you anticipate roads, facilities to operate or to make them economic?
Through the chair, Representative Hudson, at my farm site, we're actually fairly isolated despite being relatively close to the road system. We currently fly all of our product directly from our farm site to the airport in Ketchikan. And we currently produce between 1,000 and 2,000 pounds a week, all flown out. Eventually, we would like to be able to work with other farms in the area and truck it out. As the roads are improved, the ferry service is improved, and boated into a central location, into a community, process it, and truck it out.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Mulder.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Roger, there are some, when looking at this legislation, see the huge opportunity for economic growth and some real economic benefits, not only to the state, but also the people who make the investment. And for those folks, their only criticism, and it's not me, but I've heard this, just want to get on the record your explanation why, but the criticism has been made, well, if they're going to make literally millions on it, why don't they pay for the upfront cost to do to begin the program? Your response?
Yes, sir. Representative Mulder, through the chair. And that's one of the reasons I'd like the opportunity to work on these fiscal notes a little bit more with the committee. I believe industry should pay more of those upfront costs, should have a greater responsibility in providing the information that's necessary in order to analyze these sites. And I think as an example, the surveys we're providing down on Prince of Wales Island at the moment, we're doing out of a skiff, two people. If the department does a survey in the same area, they'll bring a vessel in and a team of people that will end up costing probably 50 times the amount of money that it costs for industry to really gather the same data. So, again, I do think industry should bear a significant portion of this burden and would be delighted to have the opportunity to work with the committee to bring these fiscal notes a little bit more in line.
Well, we have the department coming up here after you, so if there's no other representative, Lancaster.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Sorry I'm late. But, Roger, could you estimate what it does cost you to survey a site such as you're doing on Prince of Wales Island?
We surveyed an area that covered maybe 100 miles of shoreline last fall at a cost of $4,000. And, Mr. Chair, I would also add I've been working with the Department of Community and Economic Development on a spreadsheet that tries to show the flow of revenues back into the state treasury from the passage of this bill. And we would hope to have that available for the committee to look at within a few days.
Representative Davies.
On that, Roger, on that survey that you did, what kind of information were you getting?
Through Chair Representative Davies, we visited some clam sites and did collected samples that allowed us to analyze the number of clams that were available. We went into areas, did some soundings. We're taking salinity readings, recording water temperatures, and looking for, mostly looking for sensitive habitat and things that might cause a problem in the areas, such as extensive eelgrass or some kind of sensitive habitat that might be problematic.
You also mentioned 85.
And I also might mention that DNR has informed me that there are like 80 sites that previously were permitted for farming when the state had a one-year permitting system that were permitted and later abandoned. So we do have many areas that have been through the process and have a lot of information available.
We'll have you come back and go to the department. Doug Meekham.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Doug Meekham. I'm the Director of Commercial Fisheries for Glass Park Fish and Game, and our division is responsible for aquatic farm permits and sort of the biology of that. We testified in House Resources in support of this legislation. I think it's a reasonable approach to providing a new economic development opportunity in mariculture. We also testified we thought that the amount of money that we had suggested in these fiscal notes was a reasonable amount of money, and I didn't hear any testimony to the opposite at that time. And if there's no money that comes with this, then I think it's sort of counter to the intent of the bill. Senator Torgerson wanted to, as I said, jumpstart this industry. In a fairly short period of time, we're looking to get 90 additional sites, and there are really only 45 sites currently operating, so it would more than double the size of the industry. And as Representative Scalzi said, the idea behind this is that the department goes out and does work and finds sites that are suitable and somewhat, hopefully, free of conflicts and provides those for people to lease. And when you go out and do work, it costs money. And I guess we can argue about whether it should be $200,000 or $100,000 or $150,000. I think our department right now is down about $2.2 million in general fund on the Senate side. So I think the question is whether or not this is an economic development opportunity the legislature wants to invest in to try to jumpstart the industry. And I think that Representative Davis had a good point, that if you're not going to provide an amount of money to go out and develop these new sites and find these new sites, then what's the purpose of the legislation? Because the existing program already provides you the opportunity to do that. If you want to put the burden for finding these sites on the industry and not on the departments, they can do that. There's an opening next January, and the existing process can be used to do that. So, but I do support this legislation. Again, a reasonable approach to doing this with a reasonable amount of money with it.
Representative Lancaster.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Doug, have you ever went out and surveyed sites before on the other 45 that you've got active now?
Through the chair, Representative Lancaster, we don't do a lot of surveys, per se, of the existing suspended culture sites, but I think you're aware, other members of the committee may not be aware, that in the last few years, in the last application period, people have started to put in applications for not suspended culture sites, but rather on-bottom clam farming sites. And in fact, the department has been involved in litigation that's going to the Supreme Court. We'll be in front of the Supreme Court pretty soon for gooey ducks. These are highly valuable clams. They're worth, on the live market and the Asian market, $10, $15, $20 a pound. And some of the applications were for areas that had dense populations of gooey ducks, in some cases millions of dollars worth of resources, which are, as you know, common property resources. And when people put applications in areas like that, obviously the costs for going out there and surveying those sites, determining how many animals are there, or if there are a lot of animals there or there aren't very many, those costs are going to be higher. And during the last application period, there were 40-some applications put in. I think 19 of those sites were for on-bottom sites, and we did have to go out and survey those sites. We did it at our cost at that time, and those costs are fairly expensive. If you're talking about firing up a research vessel with divers to go out and survey subtitle sites and with scuba gear and do actual quantitative surveys and estimates of the biomass of the populations that are there, that costs money. That costs a lot of money. I don't think the private industry can do it as cheaply as we can. I think it probably cost us $20,000, let's say, for those costs. That was just in one area. This bill envisions 90 sites that are potentially anywhere in the state. And although the industry can come forward, Shellfish Growers Association, and say, we're proposing some nominations in this particular site, there's nothing to stop somebody else from saying, I want to go out to Attu. I mean, this is a big state. So, you know, the bill doesn't have any constraints on areas. If the bill said, let's just do Southeast Alaska or let's just do this area, that would be different. If the bill said, we're going to put the burden of the information gathering on the industry, that would be different too. So, you know.
Where could we amend this to just say Southeast Alaska?
Right at the top, Mr. Chairman.
Any other questions, Representative Hudson?
Thank you. Doug, something stimulates my mind to say that, was there some conflict between the dive fisheries and these set-aside sites?
Through the Chair, Representative Hudson, yes, there was during the last application period.
So if you're looking at 90 new sites here, wouldn't you have to take that into consideration as well, potential, you know, dive sites as well?
Through the Chair, Representative Hudson, yes, you would. Not for the entire 90 sites, but the bill calls for 60 suspended culture sites, 20 for clams, which is really little net clams, and then 10 for Guidex. But for a third of those sites, you would, yes. And again, that was the idea and the intent purpose of the legislation, was that the agencies would go out and do public process and biological surveys to try to find areas that don't have a priority per se for mariculture, but that when applicants come in, they have a reasonable expectation that when they put in an application for a lease site in that area, that they're going to get improved, and not that the agencies are going to come back and say, "Oh, well, that was a nice try. That's not the right place," which is very expensive for people to do in certain cases.
Any other questions for the department? Thank you. We'll go to Rick Thompson with DNR.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Rick Thompson, and I'm with the Department of Natural Resources. I supervise the statewide aquafarming program from our offices here in Anchorage. And I would just like to let the committee know that DNR has worked closely with the industry, Roger Painter in particular, Representative Scalzi's office, and the Department of Fish and Game, to work out our issues with this bill. And we're pretty comfortable with it the way it is, and we basically support it. And I would like to, and I'm available to answer any questions if you may have.
Any questions from the committee members? Thank you,
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Davies has a question.
Yeah, I just wondered if you could comment on the number of sites that are talked about in here. I don't know anything about this industry, but do you have any feeling for how practical this is going to be in terms of finding this many sites, and is in terms of both sort of the NIMBY kind of considerations that you get into in terms of people objecting to areas, and then secondly, just with respect to the potential for the industry expanding this much? In other words, is this a reasonable investment of public dollars do you think it's likely that the industry would expand into all of these sites if they were made available?
Through the Chair, Representative Davies, I don't know that I'm qualified to talk about whether or not the industry is capable of expanding into these sites should we provide them. But I think that the way it operates right now in DNR is very well versed in the difficulty in finding sites to do things. We primarily are responsive when somebody comes in and applies for a site. That's the way it's been with this program for 14 years. And going out and being upfront about finding sites means we would probably start with consulting our own area planning process to find places where aquafarming is already one of the envisioned uses. You know, just doing some work up front to eliminate some of those conflicts, but the conflict is inevitable. But we're pretty well versed in dealing with that too. We think that there will be some conflict with this, but we'll try to work that out. We also need to build in some efficiencies here when we go out to look for these sites. We may not be talking about 90 individual sites. We may be talking about some areas that could support, 5 or 10 or 15 sites. And that may build some efficiencies into this. I think it's a good idea to identify sites where and when we have the resources to do that.
Thank you, Rick.
Welcome.
We'll go to Julie Decker. Julie, are you there?
Yes, Chairman Williams, can you hear me?
Yes. Yes, yes. I guess I can hear you.
Okay. This is Julie Decker, and I'm the Executive Director of the Southeast Alaska Regional Dive Fisheries Association. And I wanted to testify in support of HB 208. Our Board of Directors met on March 8th, and they did have a consensus to support this bill. They are in support of the aquaculture industry, but there's concerns in it being to the detriment of the dive fisheries, but we believe that this bill is not to the detriment of the dive fisheries, so therefore we do support it.
Any questions for Julie? Thank you, Julie.
Thank you.
Go to John and Seward. Please state your name for the record and who you represent.
Hello, my name is John Agosti. I'm president of Alaska Shellfish Growers, and today I'm speaking for the Kachuchek Shellfish Hatchery here in Seward, where I work. Manage the hatchery. This bill is very important to our hatchery in particular, the state's sole shellfish hatchery, where we provide 4 new species of the 5 species of shellfish cultured in the state, and are the only sole source for those new species. And trying to get the industry to diversify and grow. And we view this bill as critical to help jumpstart the industry. There's been many delays, and our ability to survive off grant funding for long into the future is not going to continue. And this bill could help generate greater customers for the hatchery, which is key for our midterm survival here. I'd also like to say that we, as Alaska's only shellfish hatchery in busy Seward summers, we tour many Alaskans through the hatchery who are interested in aquatic farming. And they come and ask us many questions on all different areas of the industry. But when we mention that it's usually a 2-year process of submitting an application and going through the whole review process with less than a 50-50% chance of successfully receiving a lease and an operating permit, many are deterred from pursuing it further. Many, despite the fact that we encounter many Alaskans that are very interested in it, especially with declining fisheries and logging and other industries. They also talk to some of these other applicants, and they discover that the large cost in time and money to the many unsuccessful applicants is quite a deterrent too. And we hope this bill will make it easier for the typical Alaskan to successfully get a aquatic farming lease in an area where it is workable. And our hatchery will be working with the University of Alaska this summer in preparing and reviewing data and making site visits in Prince William Sound area, for instance, here in South Central, to nominate some sites should this bill pass, and help the many novice applicants get a foot up on this process and have a better chance of success. That's all I have to say right now. Thank you very much.
Thank you, John. Karen?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Karen Robinson, and I'm here representing myself and also as a partner in Tenaspass Shellfish Company, which is in Prince Wales Island, and with Roger Painter and my husband, but also as an owner with my family in a business here in Juneau called the Shellfish Market. And we are here in strong support of this piece of legislation, and you might say, now, why would you want more competition? And I think for many reasons. Number one is the fact that this is just an extremely exciting industry. We produce an incredible product. And here in Southeast, I distribute most of the oysters in the northern Southeast Alaska. And I can tell you my biggest fear every week is whether or not I'm going to get enough. This last week being the Easter Sunday brunch, I had everyone calling, you know, God, can you possibly make and give us the number of oysters and clams that we need for our brunches? Once the tourism season starts, then many of the restaurants open up in Haines and Skagway. And again, one of their biggest fear and my biggest fear is they call me in May. Am I going to be able to meet their needs? And unfortunately, every year it's been no. And, you know, everybody kind of gets used to it, and we come back to the fact, say, okay, can you only get 15 this week instead of the 60 dozen that they wanted? And they sell out very quickly. I also get phone calls from all over the United States asking for our product. And, I mean, I had one restaurant in Las Vegas. I mean, they wanted 600 pounds of clams each week and about 300 dozen oysters a week. You know, I just kind of said, thank you, but I can sell everything that I can get my hands on right here in Alaska. And so I'll be honest with you, I say most of our product is staying in Alaska. Thank goodness we have tourists coming from the outside who also get to enjoy it. But we have a wonderful product, not just in Southeast, but all over the state. And I think we need to do anything we can possibly do to expand it. And I certainly support it. I think most of us who are older are probably going to get worn out and out of the business before it gets to that point. But we can only hope the younger folks coming up are... have a little more energy than maybe we have left for this, and we'll jump in and take it the next step that I think the state should go in making this a really viable industry in the state, and hope that you'll pass this, and I don't care what the fiscal note is. Thank you. I don't have to worry about that either, and I'm for taxes.
Glad you got another 40 years to work before you quit. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Karen, does the bill, I haven't read it maybe as thorough as I should, but it doesn't extend the length of your contract or your lease with the state. Would that be beneficial? I mean, not only identifying the sites and trying to make more of them available, but, you know, we heard the previous gentleman say that, you know, every other year you're trying to fill out paperwork so that you can have some continuity of your business. Would that help?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Hudson, I can tell you, whatever we can do to extend would be fabulous. Just even at the Shellfish Market every year, I have to fill out the same papers and send the same $100 in. I mean, I find that it would be really easy if I could just, you know, sign a little piece of paper and send my 100 in instead of constantly filling out, you know, the paperwork that it takes. And so I think whatever we can do, I mean, everything costs. We're all on a shoestring. I can guarantee you I'd be shocked to find out that there's any farmer, any distributor in the state who's getting rich at this point. And so I think whatever we can do to assure the people who are willing to put their money in Next Online that they got a longer period of time would be very helpful.
And through the chair, what is the period? What is your lease, for example?
Again, through the chair, Representative Hudson, I would have to, our CEO, Roger, would have to answer that question.
Well, duration I'm interested in, just... Are they all uniform?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Hudson.
You'd have to come forward.
10-year leases.
Okay.
10-year leases. Yeah. Any other questions for the Representative Davies?
Karen, I appreciate the comments you're making, and I support that, but I guess my question still is, do you think that this is a kind of a reasonable level of effort to expand to begin with? I mean, is, do you really, if we did 60 or 90 sites, do you think, you know, in 10 years they'd all be taken?
Through the chair, Representative Davies, I would only hope that they'd be taken, but I think we have to start somewhere. I think that's a reasonable number to start. I think, again, I'd say every week I have someone who I run into who talks about the fact that they would like to, you know, have a site or would like to get rolling. One teacher here in town just recently was able to get a very small site going. A couple of years ago, we worked with John Pugh Jr., and he ended up buying the farm, you know, next to us. Another young person excited about, you know, getting something happening in this state regarding this issue. Another person in my office just recently heard me moaning and groaning about picking up one more 60-pound box and carrying it into my little shellfish market across the street over here, and said, oh, gosh, he thought that his wife's daughter would love to, you know, get involved in this industry, and is now beginning to talk with us about prospects for them. And so I think it's amazing how many people would love to get involved. And as the former speaker said, constantly back off from it, because it just seems so difficult to get your foot, you know, into the door to get, you know, going. And I think this is a really good step to make us move forward.
Any other questions? Thank you, Karen.
Thank you for your time. Appreciate it.
Are there any amendments? Representative Davies?
Representative Scalzi, question.
Representative Scalzi?
Representative Scalzi, I think this is a really great idea. I guess my concern is whether where the numbers came from and whether you couldn't ameliorate the fiscal note a little bit by getting rolling, you know, maybe half as many sites the first year, or, you know, or, you know, 10 sites a year or something like that. I don't know what the expectation is, you know, but just have you thought about those kinds of issues about, you know, if it put 10 or 15 out there, and if they really go, well, then let's come back next year and do some more. So.
Through the chair, Representative Davis, yes, I have thought about it. I don't know how much public anticipation is out there on who exactly would file for these sites. I think the Department of Natural Resources probably has a good estimate of what interest there is in different parts of the state. I think you have this in your packet, where we came up with the annual, the analysis for the annual revenue. If all 90 sites were leased, the possible revenue would be $58,000 annually, and that would begin in 2004. And that's based on a 3-acre site, suspended culture, equivalent to 60 sites, would be a $33,000 average. 5-acre sites on bottom culture would relatively be about $25,500. And assuming that's all, if all the sites were leased. And your question was if we just did a few. So I didn't want to be misleading earlier when I answered Representative Hudson about the fact that this should pay for itself in 10 years. That's under the assumption that all these sites would be leased. So I really can't answer your question as to how much interest would be generated immediately. I think that from the testimony we had in resources and having worked with the Department of Fish and Game over the last 2 years on this, I know that there's an extensive amount of interest, but I don't know what it would yield. So unfortunately, I can't answer. I can just say it's a gut feeling. I'm very much involved in economic development for the coastal communities. I think it's a good project, but we'd have to have a wait and see.
Representative Whitaker.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to make sure that I understand the fiscal note. I'm looking at a fiscal note that shows $98,300. Is that correct?
There's a second one also from Habitat, a little bit further back, for $90,000 and
$45,000. Right. Both.
Oh, and another one for $72,000 from, that's from Habitat also.
I'd imagine the
$90,000 is the correct one?
Yes.
So the total is $90,000 plus $98,000? $100,000.
Okay, from Fish and Game, we have $90,000 the first year, $45,000 the second year, and Habitat would be $72,000 first year and $36,500 the second year. And I want to say that DEC did have an estimate in there also, but they pulled that because they would not be a part of the process until after the
business
was certified.
DNR.
I'm looking at the
DNR's 98.
It's 98, 90, and 72.
Okay.
So 272.
Are we discussing the bill in general, Mr. Chairman?
I think so, Representative Whitaker.
Thank you, then. My comment and conclusion is this, that if we're talking about $272,000 to help a fledgling industry in areas that have been dramatically hit as a result of a number of economic downturns, that seems to me to be a fairly small increment to begin to rebuild and look to the future. And even though our budget is difficult, if we can't invest $272,000 in the future, it's a lot more difficult than it really is, because we do have significant assets available to us, and I would hate to see us forsake the future while we try to deal with this continuing budget crunch. I just speak strongly in favor of this sort of investment, Mr. Chairman, and hope that we pass this bill.
Representative Lancaster and then Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, I too am very much in favor of the bill, and I think we shouldn't discount the fact either. It was mentioned by John Agusti online, the fact that we've also built a hatchery in Seward, which in fact just delivered its first commercial project last fall. And it's just in the beginning stages of really getting on its feet and making a showing here, too, that could support these sites as we're speaking about. So I think they go hand in hand.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Do we know about how many jobs are involved in each one of these particular projects? Maybe Karen could guess how many people are on her payroll. Well, she's not here. Okay.
Perhaps.
Roger.
Roger, come on up and answer that. I know that from Ketchumack Bay, we have 14 members in the co-op, 14 individual sites, and they each employ several people. So.
Representative Hudson, through the chair, we have four full-time employees at our farm. The farm next to us that Karen mentioned, John Pugh's farm, has two full-time partners and employ some other people part-time.
So maybe three or four employees, individuals, 270 jobs if we were to run this out just on the direct, plus all of the associated jobs with it, too. Thank you. That's all I wanted to know.
I support the legislation as well. I think it's important. While if we move it on today, at the same time for the sponsor to continue working with the department as well as the producers to try and work through logical ways that we might try and achieve some efficiencies as opposed to simply forcing a showdown at the end with fiscal notes and conference committee. So if there's some way that we might achieve some savings through the utilization of information that's either been previously gathered or the ability of the producers to somehow do some of the work that would qualify, Mr. Director. If there's some way to try and fine-tune it in terms of fiscal note, that'd be appreciated. I think it still has merit standing on its own with the dollars attached to it. So, Representative Lancaster?
We move the bill then, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Lancaster?
I'd make a motion to move House Bill, or committee substitute for House Bill 208 with attached fiscal notes to be adjusted, hopefully in finance, with individual recommendations and ask for unanimous consent.
No objection to moving the bill? That brings us, thank you, Representative Scalzi. Thank you, Mr. Meekham. That brings the last bill before us. House Bill 344, and I see the sponsor.
The facsimile.
Yes, or their representative.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman. Thank you for scheduling the bill and hearing the bill. It's exciting to see the movement. The bill that's before you is House Bill 344, and it was introduced by the House Rules Committee at the request of the Division of Motor Vehicles. Passage of 344 does two things. It increases the fees for the non-commercial driver's licenses and ID cards by $5, and learner's permits will increase by $10. Considering the approximate 180,000 original issues and renewals processed annually, the increase translates into an additional $750,000 to $900,000 per year to the general fund. Also, the fee increase enables DMV to implement a conversion to the digital driver's license system. The division seeks $500,000 to fund the IT system to support the digital conversion, and they already have the capital funding for the equipment in place. Alaska is one of the three remaining states that has yet to abandon the Polaroid system. By moving beyond the 1950s era technology, Alaska steps up efforts to ensure the integrity of the nation's individual identification system. Since 911, considerable attention has been focused on the integrity of that system. The driver's licenses and ID cards are considered to be breeder documents. Once in hand, they can be parlayed into other documents like airplane tickets, passports, checking accounts, firearms permits, credit cards, among others. And just like that, a new or altered identity is set up. Keep this in mind. The driver's license is the cornerstone of the identity theft phenomenon. Last year, this little problem resulted in losses of over $700 billion, and not to mention the personal pain and suffering that goes along with that. Less glamorous, but indicative of a larger day-to-day problem that our state's restricted sales industry is facing, is the underage kids fraudulently obtaining or manufacturing IDs. You'll notice in your materials you have resolutions and support, and they tend to speak to that issue. Basically, the driver's license is far more than evidence that you passed your road test. It has become a critical component to our society's security, both personal and financial. As such, the government has a huge responsibility to ensure the integrity of that system. Think about how Alaska lives up to that responsibility. The license that you carry in your pocket has relies on technology that is basically unchanged since 1954. And I'm sure if you think about it, everyone can come up with ways or have heard of anecdotal information about how people have fraudulently obtained IDs. One simple way that you could do this is you could walk into your coworker's desk and take some mail off of their desk and walk over to the state office building, show two documents, anything, letters, doctor bills, nothing with your photograph. And if the person doesn't know you, chances are good that they will issue a driver's license with your photo and somebody else's information and social security number. Other creative ways that I've learned. Everyone's getting I know, think of it, credit cards. It's all there at your fingertips. Another creative way that, actually this was shared with me by a staff member to one of the finance committee's members. When she was in college, one of her friends who was a commercial artist student had actually created a large poster that matched the driver's license. And so the person, it was hung on a wall, so the person just stood up in front of it and a Polaroid was snapped. And then with their handy laminator, they created mass-produced fake IDs. It's very simple. We could do this down in my office because we have a Polaroid camera and we also have a laminator. By converting to a digital driver's license system, what happens is it's all computerized. The photograph is online. So we won't be able to go over to the DMV and show the mail, because if we try to do it, right online comes your photograph. And then this is a benefit for law enforcement, because when they make their traffic stops, the picture can come up online also. And then the other compelling reason, beyond all of those great ideas of why we need to convert and fund the conversion, is that the Polaroid Corporation has filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. That was last year. And I've heard in February, when the information came out, was that they're contemplating filing for Chapter 7, which means they'll be selling off their assets. And Polaroid has the patent. Everyone has probably thought of this, but the minute that digital cameras became available, there's absolutely no reason for a Polaroid photograph to exist anymore. And again, we're the last, one of the last three, and we don't have very many choices to us. And I hope that you'll support the bill. It's a win-win situation. And with me also online is Mary Marshburn from the Division of Motor Vehicles. She has more information to share with you. And then Del Smith from the Department of Public Safety will be able to address the public safety concerns of this. And he's right behind me.
All right. Thank you. Are there any questions for the sponsor before we go to Mary? Seeing none. Mary, are you online?
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I am. Mary Marshburn. I'm the Director for the Division of Motor Vehicles. Thank you for staying beyond your adjournment time. I appreciate it. As Ms. Sylvester indicates, Alaska is one of three remaining states. Two and a half years ago when we began the move to this project to try to move to a digital license, there were seven states in the United States that still had a photo license. Alaska is now one of three remaining states, the other two being Rhode Island and Oklahoma. Digital licensing, digital photography, digital technology obviously is the national standard for driver licensing. It's become even more critical in the wake of September the 11th. And House Bill 344, if passed, would help us move towards a much-needed and a very belated change in Alaska's system. Our current system is a manual process. We use pre-printed forms, photos, and a laminated security pouch. They are subject, all of the items, to theft, to fraud, and to alteration. Now, it's not quite as simple as Ms. Sylvester indicated, at least in terms of the documents presented to DMV, but the ingenuity of engineering students and others has said yes, they have been successful at duplicating the license. Within the past 4 months, just as an example, in an isolated, a single DMV office, we have had five individuals arrested for attempting to alter or obtain a license fraudulently. The advantage to a digital license, the overriding advantage, is security. It is significantly more difficult to alter or replicate. There are no pre-printed forms, pouches, or photos. The information is computer-generated. It is stored, and it is layered, fused, if you will, onto a blank. Because of the computer generation and flexibility, this enables us to have more complex and more security features on the license itself. The big plus for a digital image, in addition to the ones I just mentioned, is the fact that rather than taking a Polaroid photo, we take a digital image, which is then stored. It's available to DMV personnel to verify your identity if you come into a DMV office to renew your license or to request a duplicate license. It's available to law enforcement, and I'm sure Del Smith will testify about that. Mark Mew of the municipality of Anchorage is not available to testify today, but APD is computerizing all of their cars by 2004, and the digital license for them, as he testified in an earlier committee hearing on this bill, is a huge benefit. Last but not least, the digital license is actually a customer benefit. One, because the license is far more difficult to alter, it is a more secure piece of identification for the customer. And right now, if you're in Hawaii or traveling or out in rural Alaska and you lose your license, we can't send you a new license or a photograph on it, which can be crippling if you want to travel. With a digital license, if we have your image on file, we can call up that image, we can print the document, and we can get that license to a customer. This initiative enjoys the support of law enforcement, not only our own Department of Public Safety, but the Public Safety Employees Association, the Municipality of Anchorage, which passed a resolution in support of it, and the Anchorage Police Department. And it enjoys the support of industry because we can be a big assist to the sellers of restricted products. They actually came to me earlier this year asking what we could do for them, and were very pleased when I talked about this product. In terms of the fiscal note, as you see, we're asking for $500,000 in capital money for system development, testing, and deployment. This will provide for and integrate into our database the license generation, issuance, data, image storage, capture and storage, the transmission in-house and to law enforcement, a number of other things, including testing the system, deploying it statewide, integration with other users, and support for our software. In developing this cost, we looked over the course of the couple of years we've been working on it, we looked at other options for possible cost savings. Right now, Alaska has an over-the-counter issuance of license. You walk into a DMV, if you have the appropriate documentation and if you have the money, you're then handed a license back or you leave with your license in hand. We looked at centralizing the issuance of the driver's license, which means that you would go to the DMV, have your picture captured, your application paperwork, but you would not walk
out with a license. It would be mailed to you from a central facility. We looked at a combination of over-the-counter and...